Tonight's learning is dedicated to Leila Nishmas Rivka Bas Avram. Parsha Shlach is a jammed-packed parsha. It's not even shayich to get to so much information and so much to talk about in this week's parsha. We're going to try our best to get to everything, but obviously there's going to be some things that we just don't get to. I'm trying to remember what we covered in other years. I remember in other years we focused more on the Mekoshish, and other years we focused more on the Meraglim. Well, we're going to try this year to get to a little bit of everything, but again, it is a very, very loaded parsha. Very quickly, a quick overview of what to expect in Parsha Shlach. So obviously we know what dominates most of the parsha, or at least a good chunk of the parsha, is the story of the Meraglim. The Meraglim and the after effects and the punishment of the Meraglim. There's also a very small story that we need to talk about this evening that is often overlooked. That is a post-Meraglim event. That after the Jewish people were told and they got yelled at for the Meraglim, they basically said, okay, Hashem, now we're ready to go to Eretz Yisrael, and we'll have to talk about that story, as well as the idea of the Nisuch, the pouring of the wine and the flour and the oil at the Karbonos. And the other three, there's another event also in the parsha, not an event, halacha. The Torah talks about aveiros that are done b'shkaga, karbonos that need to be brought if the entire community sins, if an individual sins. And then the end of the parsha has two mitzvahs. One is the mitzvah of challah, which needs to be discussed not only from a hashkafic outlook, but there's quite some interesting halacha to discuss challah. It's b'li neder on my to-do list still to have a halacha shiur about the halachas of challah. That's something I would like to talk about still. And as well as the mitzvah of tzitzis, which we already discussed in previous halacha shurim. We discussed different parts of halacha tzitzis, as well as the concept of, is there tcheles bizman hazeh? I'm not going to get into that this evening. I would like to discuss, maybe if there's time, a hashkafic outlook to the concept of white strings and blue strings. So those are the major, major topics that can be found in the pages of this week's parsha. As I always like to begin with the Rabbeinu Bechaya's Hakdama to this week's parsha, Rabbeinu Bechaya has his introduction to the parsha. He always opens up with a pasuk found somewhere in the Neviim, Ksuvim. And he shows that this pasuk is a theme or somehow relates to something in this week's parsha. And the pasuk that he chooses this week is a pasuk that connects obviously to the parsha, but I think it's so relevant for all of our lives, and it's something we need to live by. And the pasuk is found in Mishlei Chaf Aleph Lamanav. The pasuk tells us, Sus mucham liyei milchama. A horse should be prepared for the day of war. V'la Hashem hatishua. But to Hashem will come this salvation. Says Rabbeinu Bechaya, what is pshat in this pasuk? And he explains this pasuk is the idea that we all know of today and we all live with, and that's called Teva and Hishtadlus. We live in a world today of natural occurrences. There is a certain amount of normalcy in the world. If a person jumps, crosses the street in front of a moving car, he will get hit by the car. If a person moves in front of a bullet, if a person passes in front of a bullet, he will get struck by the bullet. If a person jumps into a fire, he will get burned. These are all called Teva, and it's all called natural occurrences. We as Jews, says the Pasuk in Mishlei, have to live with this Teva. We can't say to ourselves, don't worry, Hashem will protect me, Hashem will guard me, I can do dangerous things, I can do hazardous things, but don't worry, Hashem will protect me. That is not true. That is the antithesis of Jewish values. We believe that there's Teva, and Teva says that if a person does something dangerous, he will get affected. So when a person gets ready for war, what does he have to do, says the Pasuk in Mishlei? He needs to prepare for war on a Teva based, on a natural occurrence, which means he has to have weapons, he has to have a horse, he has to have a plan for war. But he also has to remember, after all is said and done, where does the salvation come from? It doesn't come from the horses, it doesn't come from the weapons, it doesn't come from the plans for war, but LaHashem HaTeshua comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we as Jews can see this very clearly in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, when the Israeli government is tested with some form of a war or some form of a battle, what do? They prepare like any other country would. They get the troops ready, they have the ammunition ready, they have the guards ready, and they have the guns and all that ready. But at the end of the day, it's LaHashem HaTeshua. The salvation comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the uniqueness of what we have today in Eretz Yisrael, where we have a physical army, and we have those people that are learning Torah that are also protecting Klal Yisrael. And you need them both to work. You can't just have people learning Torah, and you can't just have people fighting in the war. You have to have a combination. That's mamish this pasuk in Mishlei. Everything in this world that we do, we have to have a plan for. We can't not go to work and say, Hashem will give me food. We can't not go to our job or look for a job or go to college or whatever you need today to get a job and say, oh, Hashem will provide for me. You have to have a plan. This is what became today the famous term in Shidduchim, that the boy, a man with a plan, that boy has to have some way of providing for his family. Of course, who knows what the road will present and who knows what will happen. Life changes, of course. But you have to have at least a mahalach, you have to have a basic plan of how you're going to provide in this world. We live in a world of teva, we live in a world of normalcy, and in a normal world, tuition costs a lot of money, and food costs a lot of money, and rent costs a lot of money, and if you don't have a way that you're going to provide for your family, you're not going to get too far. But at the end of the day, Zakta Pasik Vala Hashem Achua, it all comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu anyways. So this is the major balance that we discussed many times here between Hishtadlus and Emunah and Bitachim Bashem. We all have to do our Hishtadlus, and then after that, after we put in our Hishtadlus, at that point we say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, okay, now you take over. A person works very hard on a certain project for his job, and he does all that he's supposed to do, and it's successful, so he gives the credit to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if it's not successful, and nothing comes out of it, that's also what Hashem wants. So Zogta Ben Avichai, I think this idea is so important for all of us to live with, because we all have to deal with things in life that seem to not make sense of why it is this way. Why do I have to be busy with something which is not producing anything for me? The answer is that's part of teva. That's part of this. And we hope that the Baruch Hu will show us or give us the outcome that we hope for and that we anticipate. But Zakt Rabbein Bechaya, that's very much relevant in this week's parasha. In this week's parasha, the Bnei Yisrael initially wanted miraglim for the purpose of understanding. We're coming into a, you have to remember the mindset of the Jewish people. They were living in the Midbar. The Midbar was an abnormal lifestyle. It was a spiritual lifestyle where there was no physicality. There was no teva. They had clothing that didn't wear out. They had food that wasn't natural. They were protected by clouds. That's not the normal way the world runs. And they were entering into the new realm, a realm of regular world. A world where you have to fight your enemies. A world where you have to know your surroundings. You have to know the landscaping. You have to know what to anticipate. So on that level, the idea of the miraglim was not against HaKadosh Baruch Hu's wants and wishes. Klal Yisrael was not used to such a lifestyle. And they wanted to know more about such a lifestyle. The problem was what the answer the miraglim came back with. But on its basic level, says Rabbeinu Bechaya, the concept of doing hishtadlus and working to a world of teva is not something that the Torah is against. It's actually something very much embraced by Torah ideology. We live in a world of nature. We have to follow the nature. We have to work with the teva. We have to work with the normalcy. And we have to do our hishtadlus to obtain the outcome. So the parasha opens up where Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu, Shlach lecho anoshim. Send for yourself men, v'yosuru es eretz Kanan, and they will search out, they will check out the land of Kanan, asher ani nosei livnei Yisrael, that I plan to give to the Jewish people. So the first Rashi, the opening Rashi, one of the most famous Rashis in Chumash, I think, for sure, in Parshas Bamidbar, Rashi is bothered with the juxtaposition between last week's Parsha and this week's Parsha. Last week's Parsha, we ended off with a very difficult story, a storyline of Miriam Hanaviyah, the great Miriam, the famed sister of Aaron and Moshe, who spoke somewhat Lashon Hara on her brother. It's still not clear what exactly was the terrible Lashon Hara that she spoke. Halavai, all our Lashon Hara should be as bad as Miriam's Lashon Hara. But whatever the case may be, HaKadosh Baruch Hu viewed her Lashon Hara as a grave sin, and therefore she got punished with Tzaras, and that's the closing end, that's the end of last week's parasha. So Rashi says, what's the connection between that and the story of the Miraglim? As the Sif Sechama points out, they were not exactly next to each other in historical storyline, timeline. So Rashi answers a famous Chazal, because what was last week's parasha? Miriam got punished, she got hit because of her speech, Ba'achay on her brother, and Urishayim Halalu, these evil Miraglim, they saw they did not take the proper musr. So there's so much to unload in this first Rashi. We could probably spend the whole Chumash here unloading on this first Rashi, breaking it down, understanding it, but we will not. We'll just point out some obvious ha'aras that many of the Mefarshim ask on this Rashi. So first of all, what does Rashi seem to be saying? Rashi seems to be saying that the time that we have on the Miraglim is they should have learned from Miriam. So the first glaring question is, what do you mean they should have learned from Miriam? They should have learned Hilchas Lashon Hara and the Mishnah Berurah and Hilchas Mechilas. They know there's such a thing called Lashon Hara. They need to learn from Miriam not to speak Lashon Hara. They need to know Halacha. Halacha says you're not allowed to speak evil on something. What do you mean they have to learn from Miriam? What's this added notion of they should have learned from Miriam? Forget Miriam. They should have learned Hilchas Lashon Hara. That's question number one. Question number two is the other glaring question that many Mefarshim ask, is that it's not a good comparison. Miriam got punished, and Miriam did wrong because she spoke Lashon Hara on a human being. She spoke Lashon Hara on her brother. Her brother's a bas v'dam. A bas v'dam has feelings and emotions, and you spoke ill on someone, you make them feel bad, you hurt their feelings. However, who did the Meraglim hurt when they spoke ill of Eretz Yisrael, the land of Eretz Yisrael, the rocks and the stones and the earth? Whose feelings did they hurt? So Mechateisa, there's even a prohibition of Lashon Hara when the Lashon Hara is not on a person. I speak Lashon Hara on an object. So we've mentioned in other years in Parashat Shlach, we mentioned the Shita of the Arayim, which Mishnah Berurah brings down the Halacha, that if you speak ill on an object, let's say I speak Lashon Hara about your car, and I say you have a junky car, you have a junky house, you have this, so I'm insulting your car. The answer is no, you're insulting the owner of the car. You're insulting the person who bought the car. That's an insult to me. So that's Lashon Hara on me. So many Mefarshim point out, well, if you're speaking ill of the land, well, whose land is it? It's Hashem's land. So you're really speaking ill of HaKadosh Baruch. But the kasha that many Mefarshim have is that the comparison seems to be flawed. Miriam's Lashon Hara was on a human. So Yechrami, the Meraglim would never speak ill on a person. But they weren't speaking ill on a person. They were speaking ill on the land. The land has no feelings and has no emotions. Reb Chatzko Levenstein, the Mir Mashkiach, the Panovich Mashkiach, he was also a mashkiach in the Lomza Yeshiva in Petach Tikva. He was a mashkiach in quite a few places. He got around Reb Chatzko Levenstein. So Reb Chatzko Levenstein writes that the Musar Haskil from this Rashi is the words, Ra'u v'loy lokcho Musar. Everything in life we have to have our eyes open to. We need to be willing to learn, to gain, to grow. He says the problem over here is Ra'u v'loy lokcho Musar. Whatever the tzushta, the comparison is it's this nekuda, this idea of watching and seeing and being motivated by. Very, very, very often things happen in our life that we see them, we acknowledge them, but it doesn't change who we are. You saw it and it didn't move you, it didn't change you, it didn't affect your life. But the classical pshat that is found in many of the Acharonim, how to understand this Rashi, is that the comparison to Miriam was actually very apropos. Miriam spoke Lashon Hara on a person. Now you can argue, who did she speak Lashon Hara about? Moshe Rabbeinu. You think Moshe Rabbeinu was insulted? Moshe Rabbeinu, anav mikalada. Moshe Rabbeinu for sure was not bothered by what Miriam said about him. And nonetheless, it's a taina. Why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu was given an adam chashav. He was an important person. So people say same thing with the land. The land also has kedusha. Kedusha is Eretz Yisrael, means the land is kedush. You can't speak ill of things that are holy. You can't speak ill of people that are holy. Or the other way people say it is that just like Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't insulted because it's adam mikalada, so too the land is not insulted. And achal pikein, it's aser. That's the way many people want to make the sushta. But the underlining theme in the comparison between the two things is the same idea. Miriam HaNeviah might have had noble reasons for doing what she did. And she did. She was not trying to speak ill of her brother to bash her brother that he separated from his wife. He was bothered, he was concerned, he was worried. Why are you separating from your spouse? We don't separate from our spouses. Her heart was in a good place. And nonetheless, she got into trouble. Because sometimes in life, it's not about where your heart is, but you have to do what is actually right. You know, sometimes in life, it's not good enough. Well, I had good intentions. No, no. And that's really a theme throughout this entire parasha, is good intentions is not enough to live your life by. You have to follow the rules on the books. And that's the theme throughout this entire parasha, starting from the Meraglim and really from Miriam all the way through to the Mekoshesh. Very often in life you have people, but my intentions were good. So I cheated on my taxes, but my intentions were good because I wanted to give money to a yeshiva. My intentions were good. I insulted my friend, but I had a good reason for doing it. No, that doesn't fly. Miriam might have had all the reasons in the world, and she was lishma. I am not chas v'shalom at all speaking ill on Miriam and Aviyah. You know, that's not my agenda here. But Lamaisa, with all the pure intentions, she did some form of an avir. The Meraglim had the same thing. They might have had pure intentions, and they might have done this lishma, as we'll see tonight. They had their own reasons why they did this. After all is said and done, it doesn't work. You gotta follow the rules. You gotta be honest, you have to tell the truth. If the truth is the truth, you have to tell the truth. And if not, you have to know how to say it. That's one, I think, very important yisoid that comes out of this week's parasha. And the other pshat that is also found in many Gedalia Achrayim is that Miriam looked at the situation, and she could have, if she would have looked a little deeper, she could have found some form of a limud zchus. Moshe Rabbeinu must have had a cheshbon, he must have spoke to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right away, we jump to conclusions that it's no good. But sometimes, if we would just look at it with a more of a positive outlook, we'd say to ourselves, no, Moshe Rabbeinu, he spoke to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he probably got a special din from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But sometimes we don't want to look at it like that. We want to look for the negativity. We want to look for the problems. We want to look for the bleak and depressing part of things. So that was the same thing with the Meraglim. The Meraglim, if they would have looked open-mindedly and wide open with positivity, all the things that they saw in Eretz Canaan would have came back positive. But when you're ready for Abisad, and you're ready for Tainid, and you're ready coming in with a negative attitude, then no matter what you see, it's going to come out bad. So that's another theme that is very important in this week's parasha. It's all how you look at things. Very often in life, you can look at something and come out with the most positive outlook, while people can look at something and come out with the most negative. So Miriam also had this. If she would have looked deeper into her brother's story, perhaps she would have said, nah, my brother's not doing anything wrong. My brother must have spoken to Hashem, and Hashem gave him a special tzivu. But she didn't. Same thing here also with the Meraglim. If the Meraglim would have looked a little deeper in and said, you know what, it's not so bad there. It's Israel. It's got its bumps in the road, but we can do it. We can handle it. But instead, they had such a negative approach. The Baal HaTurim tells us that the word Shlach Lecho Anoshim, the Soifei Teves, the last letter of the word, spells the word Chacham. The Ches, Chof, Mem, spells Chacham. Zokti Baal HaTurim Shu Anoshim Chachom V'Tzadikim. Again, this is another issue we have to deal with this evening, is the contradiction in Chazal to who were the Meraglim. Were they, like the Baal HaTurim calls them, Chachomim V'Tzadikim? Or as we'll see later on, Rashi has a comment that they referred to as, we just read before, Rishoyim Halalu. How do we make these two things work? Were they Chacham of Tzadikim or Rishoyim? Now again, a person can be a Chacham and a Rosh at the same time. Chachma might be intellectual knowledge, doesn't mean you're Tzadik. But here, the Baal HaTurim says they are Chacham of Tzadikim. Then the Rashi tells me they are Rishoyim. So we have to see how to make all these different things work. One of my most favorite Kliyokers is found in this week's Parsha. Yaakov says in the pasuk, "Shlach lecho anoshim." Hashem says to Moshe Rabbeinu, "You send the men." So the Kliyakar makes a couple of diukim over here. He says, first of all, he says, "You at davka at techze ruach hakodesh anoshim k'shem azeshlichos." You need to use ruach hakodesh. Hashem tells Moshe to figure out who you pick the messengers. You figure out who the right people are for this job. Why? Because he says, "Ki roiva oylam toyim ba'anoshim chanifim amarim esasim k'shem." Today, you can put on a great show, and you can make yourself look like a big tzaddik, and you're nothing there. It's empty inside. Therefore, says the Kliyokar, I want you to find someone lecho anoshim, davka oisim shem beinecho anoshim chashuvim. I want you to pick them, the people who you consider to be chashuv. And then the Kliyokar says another pshat, which is fantastic, and it's so true. He says that throughout Tanakh, you find that the women always were much more optimistic than the men. And this is something we speak a lot about. That the women were always much more optimistic when things got dicey, things got complicated. In Jewish history, the women were always much more optimistic. For example, the Chet Egel, the women were much more not willing to give in to the Chet Egel. The women had a much more positive outlook, stamazay, on life. And the Kliyokar says, specifically when it came to Eretz Yisrael. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe Rabbeinu like this, you should know, I really would prefer sending women. I would prefer sending women. Listen to this Kliyokar. Fantastic. He writes, says the Kliyokar, he writes, the women hated Eretz Yisrael. But the women loved Eretz Yisrael. Hashem said, I see the future. Send women who love Eretz Yisrael. They would never speak ill of Eretz Yisrael. But you, but you think men are better. You think men love Eretz Yisrael, so you send the men. Said HaKadosh Baruch Hu, me personally, I'd send women. Can you imagine the world that the HaKadosh Baruch Hu would have sent 12 females to go search out the land? This is just a raya that the Torah is not a sexist religion. We value women's opinion very much. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I would have preferred the women. They would have came back with a much more positive report. Again, I don't know how you'd be able to have all the women standing up and all the men sitting down. It's not sneeze, this and that. Okay, fine, I'm not sure. But the Maiz is Azizak the Kliyakar. Then the Kliyakar points out another Pshat. He says, again, what's the Anoshim? So he said, because the contrast Anoshim to Noshim is because women are a little bit more of a shmoozy population. Famous Gemara in Kedushim, Tisha Kaba, Sicha Yod Loilam, Tisha Not Lanoshim. So he says, I want you to take men that don't talk so much. They don't blabber so much. They don't chat so much. And therefore they won't speak ill of Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so this is the idea of the Meraglim. Now there's just a kasha over that needs to be asked, that the Mefarshim also grapple with, is if you look at the Haftorah that's from this week's parasha, the Haftorah is from Yoshua. What happens in the story of Yeshua? Yeshua also sends spies. Yeshua also sends, he doesn't send 12, he sends two. He sends two people in to figure out what's going on in Eretz Yisrael. And his shlichus was very successful. So many Mefarshim ask, first of all, why was Moshe Rabbeinu's meraglim not successful and Yeshua's were meraglim? Were successful, but perhaps a different question is, Yeshua was a Talmud Muvik of Moshe Rabbeinu. So you would have assumed he'd follow whatever his Rebbe did. If his Rebbe found meraglim to be a non-successful endeavor, why would Yeshua take the chance of doing it himself? So if you look in the Haftarah, there's a very important line in the Haftarah, which is found in the beginning of Sefer Yeshua. The word of the Pasuk is like this. The Pasuk says, by the describing, this is in the beginning of Perek Beis, of Sefer Yeshua, Vayishlach Yeshua ben Nun min Ashitim Shneim Anoshim, sent two, Miraglim Cheresh. What's Cheresh? So if you look at the Mefarshim, there's a couple different shatim what Cheresh means. One shat means quietly. He did the shashtil. This was supposed to be an undercover, incognito Miraglim, to go check out the land. And this is the whole story of Rochav and the Zayna, the famous story. And then one of the pshatim is that cheresh means that he should be like a deaf person. Radak brings down these pshatim, they should be deaf. So Rabbi Fran points out a beautiful idea in activism in his sefer. He says that perhaps the success of the miraglim the second time by Yeshua was the attitude of deafness. What does deafness mean? Very often in life you have people that want to do things. They have a drive, they have a desire, they have a plan, they have a will. And all they hear are naysayers. That's never going to be successful. That moisture is never going to work. The shear is never going to take off. That community is never going to be successful. They're never going to... Everyone has naysayers. Says Rabbi Fran, sometimes in life you have to be deaf. Don't listen to them. Tune out the naysayers. Tune out all those people that are telling you it's not going to work, it's bad. That was the difference. When the second round of Miraglin, their attitude was, I don't want to hear all this negativity. I don't want to hear all the negativity. I don't want to hear all the problems and all the... I'm looking with a fresh, optimistic slate. And that's such an important lesson to me in life of anyone that's ever been involved in activism in Klal Yisrael, trying to get things done. There's so many people that tell you you're not going to succeed. It's not going to work. You have this problem, you have that problem, you don't have enough money, you don't have enough people, you don't have enough clout, or whatever the excuses are. And if we were to always listen to them, we would get nothing done in Klal Yisrael. So sometimes we have to make ourselves a deaf. We have to not listen to all the naysayers so in order we can actually get things done and be successful when we tune out. We become like a cheresh. A person becomes like a deaf person. He does not listen. He does not hear to all the negativity and all the naysayers. So who does Moshe Rabbeinu choose to be his representatives in checking out the land? So he says, Pasuk tells us they took a nasi. Pasuk says, who do they choose for this job? So the pasuk says that ish echad lemateh avo yisof teshlochu kol nasivam. Each shevet had a representative, and each shevet had a representative. Each nasi was the representative. The pasuk tells us Moshe sent out the nasiim ve'elish shemaisam. He gives us the name Mateh Reuven Shamu ben Zakur. Now it's interesting that this kasha bothered me for some time. That if you look in last week's parsha and parshas Baloischa, the nasiim of last week's parsha don't match the nasiim in this week's parsha. Not all of them are the same person. So I found Reb Zalman Sirotsky Mavorn's this kasha. So he wants to suggest a big chiddush. He wants to suggest, he doesn't think that they died. There wasn't that much time in between to suggest that so many different nesim died. But he suggests, this is something I thought about and I thought maybe it wasn't allowed to be said, but he wanted to suggest that maybe these people were not halachic nesim. Why do you need a big rabbi and a white beard to check out Eretz Yisrael? You need those guys that know the land, they know agriculture, and they know war, and they know society. Those are the guys you need to send. They don't have to be necessarily the biggest nesiim, the leaders of the shevet, the representative of the shevet, the most chashuv person. Who needs that? You just need people that can represent and come back and tell you, we saw the landscape, we saw the people, we saw the land, we saw this. You don't really need to be a greiser Talmud Chacham to report back. But that's a question if we're willing to say that. Rabbi Soloveitchik explained that the idea of the shlichos hamaraglim was not necessarily the way it ended up playing out. Rabbi Soloveitchik suggested that the idea of the shlichos hamaraglim was just like, you know, the halacha is you're not going to be mekadesh an ish until you see her. So when Klal Yisrael is going to become united with Eretz Yisrael, we need to see it first. So these people were just a representation of those to see the land, check out the land, build a relationship with the land. And I think one of the rises from the fact that the Baal HaTurim says that Shevet Levi did not have a representation because they don't have a chelik in Eretz Yisrael. They don't have a specific relationship with Eretz Yisrael. They don't have a chaluk in Eretz Yisrael. So the whole idea, the whole purpose of these meraglim wasn't just to see, it was to build a relationship, to become equated with Eretz Yisrael. There's a machloikis b'shoyin between the Ramban and the Sforno in this week's parasha. What exactly is the order of the Nesiim? We start off with Reuven, then we go to Shimon, then we have Yehuda, Yisachar, Ephraim. It's all out of order. So is the order somehow reflective of the Nesiim's chashivas, which is one opinion, which if that's the case, if the order of the Nesiim is reflective of the Nesiim's chashivas, if you just take a quick look at the names, you'll find something which maybe shocks you, that where exactly is Kalev and Yeshua? Yeshua is number 3 on the list, and Yeshua is much later, lower down in the list. Yeshua is number 5 on the list. So if you measure the list by most chashiv, it comes out that number 3 and number 5 on the list were Yeshua and Kalev, which means they were by no stretch of the means the most chashiv of the Nesiim. Which is not, I'm not saying it's a kasha, but it just comes out something very, very interesting. So Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky explains that the reason why the order of the Nesiim is really out of order, with no order, he says because that's how the whole request of the Meraglim came out. Rashi tells us later on in Sefer Devarim that the way they came to request the Meraglim was Baravuvya. They came with this big hullabaloo. They didn't come with a methodical, thought-out, well-presented PowerPoint presentation to Moshe Rabbeinu to why we need Meraglim. They all just came running, and the kids were talking before the adults. It wasn't Misudar. It was just a big, big hullabaloo of people. And the Mefarshim point out that was a raya, that this was not done kedas u'kedin. Things that are done kedas u'kedin, you come methodically and clearly, and you have a plan, you have details, and you have, ways of presenting it. So says Reb Yaakov, since the whole presentation was done in a mix-up, that's why the names of the Nesiim are also found with no particular order, and just in some form of a mixture and a combination. Then we come to the famous Pasuk. Pasuk tells us about that Moshe Rabbeinu vayikra Moshe lo Yishea ben Nun Yehoshua. Moshe Rabbeinu is in the name changing business. He changes Yehoshua's name from Hoshea to Yehoshua. Why is that Rashi? Famous Gemara in Saita. Hispalul Olav. He davened Ko Yoshiach Yud K, Hashem's name. Hashem should save you me'atzas miraglim, from the plan of the Meraglim. That's the Lashon of Rashi. Me'atzas Meraglim, from the Eitzah, from the suggestion, from the plan of the Meraglim. So again, this Rashi comes along with many, many, many Ha'aras. One of the most famous Ha'aras, first of all, what happened to Kalev? Why did, or for that matter, all the other of the Meraglim? Meaning if Moshe Rabbeinu felt that the Meraglim were perhaps in some form of risk, or some form of spiritual danger, so daven for all of them. Why only daven for Yeshua? Secondly, what's this two things? There's davening and there's changing his name. What is that all about? What is the significance of changing his name, and what is the significance of davening for him? Thirdly, where do we ever find that you can daven for someone when it comes to something like Yerushalayim? Hakol bidei Shemayim chutz miYerushalayim. Yerushalayim, I can daven. It's not up to my tefillas. Yerushalayim is about you making the right decisions. Klapei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Rav Moshe Bick in his Sefer Chayim Moshe has two very nice pshatim. And one of his pshatim is based on a famous Zohar, which we have to mention. Again, a difficult Zohar, but a famous Zohar that is mentioned by many Gedolim, many Mefarshei HaChumash mentioned this Zohar. And the Zohar says the following. What was the Cheshbon of the Meraglim? Lamaisa, we have to explain. Why did the Meraglim, 10 out of 12, come back with such a negative approach? And the Zohar says, because the Meraglim were afraid that once they move into Eretz Yisrael, they're going to be out of a job. They were afraid that their entire power, their entire covet, or whatever leadership role they had as a Nasi, which again, just think about this for a second. It wasn't even a paying job. I think Abraham Shulevitz makes this observation. I don't think it's my chiddush. He points out that what was the covet about over there? It was money? Wishka money. Everyone got money. There was no extra perks. Well, they didn't have to pay. They got parsonage. They didn't have to pay taxes. What was it? It was covet. Whatever the covet was. It wasn't even a financial covet. They got the mizuchvat. I'm not sure. I'm not exactly sure what it was. But Lamaisa the Zohar says they were afraid that whatever leadership role they had, they would lose it once they moved into Eretz Yisrael. So they wanted to suggest as best as they can to keep the people in the middle. This is the famous Zohar. Now again, just mikatz al katz, the other accepted pshat that many Mefarshim give was a little bit more favorable of the Meraglim was the exact opposite. Not that the Meraglim wanted to stay in the Midbar for their own benefit, they wanted to stay in the Midbar for the Bnei Yisrael's benefit. Either they felt that the Bnei Yisrael is not fit to live in Eretz Yisrael. They're not there yet. They're not on that madrega that they can live a life of teva. They still need to be cuddled and they still need to be in that protective cocoon of the midbar. And therefore, they're not yet ready to move on. That's another pshat that many mefarshim work with, which again is the exact opposite pshat, but it definitely shines a much more favorable light on the miracle. But in any case, there's one last nekuda that we need to speak out before we get to Reb Moshe Bix Teres. There's a Targum Yonasan Ben Ozil on this week's parsha. Now, I never knew this before, but I had the privilege of going to a chasan on Lakewood this week. So whenever you go travel a lot, one of the perks that you get to listen to shurim, you get to listen to a lot of things, which is one of the reasons I'm over extra on top of the regular excited to come back to the Young Israel in person, was it gives me the opportunity to drive again. I don't get much schar halicha for my jobs here. My yeshiva where I teach is across the street from my house, and my shul where I'm the rabbi is down the block from my house. I don't get much schar halicha. So when I get to drive to Young Israel, I get schar halicha, but more than anything, I get to listen to shurim in the car, which is very, very enjoyable. So I had the privilege of listening to one of Rev Schechter's hour and a half long, and I think it took me almost my whole trip to Lakewood, Baruch Hashem, I got to hear his entire chumash. And he mentioned something which I've never heard before. He says that there are those who say that the Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel on Chumash is not really Yonasan ben Uzziel. Yonasan ben Uzziel only wrote on parts of the Navi. I forgot which one, either Nevi'im or Ksuvim. But the Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel that we have on Chumash is actually really Targum Yushalmi. That was the first I've ever heard of that, so I'm just saying that over. I haven't heard either way, but that was something that he mentioned. He says some people say that. I don't know if he himself is convinced, but he mentioned such a possibility that the Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel that we have on Chumash was actually not written by Yonasan ben Uzziel, but rather written from the Yerushalmi. But in any case, this is one of those famous Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel in this week's parasha. The Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel adds a couple of words to the pasuk. The pasuk says that Moshe called Yehoshea ben Nun Yeshua, says the Targum Yonasan, Uchedichama Moshe Avsanusei. When Moshe saw the great anivus, the modesty, the humbleness that his Talmud Yeshua had, Kara Moshe Leishe ben Nun Yeshua. That's when Moshe changed his name. So everyone jumps on this Targum Yonasan ben Uzziel. What does the anivus of Yeshua have to do with his name change? What's the shaychus? So the classical answer that everyone says is that when a person is an anav, very often he is embarrassed, humbled, modest. He doesn't want to express his own opinion. And he just goes along with the mass. He goes along with the people. So Moshe Rabbeinu was very afraid that in this storyline, if Yeshua is going to follow the mass, he's not going to stand up for his values. He's not going to express his feelings. We're going to have a big problem. It's not going to work out. So therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu had to daven because of Yeshua's anivus, because Yeshua was so humble. And humble people very often are not willing to fight the tide. They're not willing to go against the mass. They're not willing to stand up and take a stand. So that's why Moshe Rabbeinu had to daven for Yeshua. That's the classical answer that the Mefarshim point out, which again is also a character flaw. Anivus doesn't mean you're a pushover. Anivus doesn't mean you're a shmata that you can walk over. Anivus means you know who you are, but you realize your talents come from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They see over a story with Rav Moshe Feinstein, the great Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein was a very humble person, but Rav Moshe Feinstein was talking and learning with someone. And the person was talking disrespectful. He was yelling and screaming. So Rav Moshe Feinstein said to him very nicely, you have to know. Do you know who you're talking to? Now Rav Moshe wasn't trying to be a Baal Kaiva. Rav Moshe was saying that you have to know that you don't scream at a Gadol Hador. So Rav Moshe knew who he was, but he also was very humble. But sometimes humbleness has a line also. And another story with Rav Moshe Feinstein where someone said to Rav Moshe Feinstein, are you aware of the Prima Gadim? The Prima Gadim is against your psak. Rav Moshe said, yeah, I read the Prima Gadim 26 times. I know the Prima Gadim. So anivus doesn't mean you turn yourself into a format. Anava means you appreciate and you understand who you are, but sometimes you need to be able to express, especially if the attitude is a negative attitude, you have to be able to go against it. So Rav Moshe Bix wants to explain, based on all of this, one more thing. Rav Moshe Bix is bothered with the lashon of atzas miraglim. What does it mean, the plan of the miraglim? What was this plan of the miraglim? So he explains, because of the Zoya. The plan of the miraglim was that they're going to make up not to go into Eretz Yisrael because they don't want to lose their job. So explains, says Rav Moshe Bix, but Yeshua, it wasn't a gear to Yeshua, this cheshbon. Why? Because Yeshua knew that he was going into Eretz Yisrael. Yeshua knew good and well he was going to leave in Eretz Yisrael. So that wasn't a cheshbon for Yeshua, but because of his anivus, he might give in to the people. He might give in to the people, even though, again, he's got no reason to stay in the Midbar, because he knows he's leading, he knows he has a leadership role in Eretz Yisrael. So he's got all the reason to go into Eretz Yisrael. But because he's such an anav, he goes along with the people, he goes along with the mass. Yeshua might have just went along with the people, even though he had no real gain by following their evil plan. That's one pshat. And then he has even a more geshmaka pshat. He wants to suggest that the Meraglim could have just killed Yeshua. They could have killed him. He says that's Atzas Yeshua. That's the Atzas Meraglim. The plan of the Meraglim could have been to kill Yeshua. And that Moshe Rabbeinu could daven for. You can daven that someone should be saved. That's like davening for a chayla. The kasha we had with, what do you mean to daven that Yeshua should make the right decision? That's Yerushalayim. They weren't davening that. They were davening that Yeshua's life shouldn't be in danger. That these Meraglim, they are not going to go kill him. And he explains that's why they didn't have to daven for Kalev, because Kalev presented himself like he was on their side. Kalev was a very sneaky guy. Kalev, Rashi said, was echad bepev, echad belev. He was able to tell them what they wanted to hear, but he, deep down in his heart, he knew what he wanted to do. He was a slick guy, Kalev. Yeshua wasn't that. Yeshua was too honest. Yeshua couldn't utter sheker. If he, the Chafetz Chaim points this out, as do others, the difference between Yeshua and Kalev. That's why they made a good partnership. Yeshua couldn't get the sheker out. He had to tell you what he feels. So Yeshua was at risk for being killed. He's going to get up and tell the Meraglim what he thinks. They'll just kill him. Like the Pesukim say later on, they tried to do that to Kalev when Kalev finally spoke out against what they believed in. So Yeshua was too honest. He couldn't say a sheker. He didn't know how to express sheker. But Kalev was able to play the game. Kalev was able to tell them what they want to hear. And therefore Kalev wasn't at any risk to his life, and therefore they didn't have to daven for Kalev. The other classical answer that the Mefarshim give to why Moshe davened for Yeshua and not Kalev, because Yeshua was Moshe Rabbeinu's Talmud. He's a guy that Talmud. How can he allow his Talmud to go astray? The Al-Shulch says, you see from this week's parashah, that when your Talmud is struggling, you got to daven for him. That's the role of a Rebbe. A Rebbe has to daven for his Talmidim to make sure his Talmidim stay on the straight and narrow and they do what they're supposed to do. There's a story that came out after Reb David Soloveitchik passed away, but I actually saw this story recorded before he died. But the story came out much more popular after he died. There was a bacher who wanted to learn by Reb David's yeshiva, Reb David Soloveitchik Zatzal. He wanted to learn his yeshiva, and Reb David Soloveitchik told him, I can't take you into yeshiva, you're not part of the yeshiva. So the bacher said, so can I sit in the Beis Medrash and learn? Yeah, sit. But you should know you're not part of the yeshiva. So the bacher said, okay. So the bacher sat for a Seder and he sat in the yeshiva. And then the Bacher came a few weeks later to the Reb David and said, can I maybe listen to the Chaburs and the Shurim? He said, fine, but you're not part of the yeshiva. Okay, so fine. Then the Bacher said, can I come second Seder? And the same answer, yeah, you can do it, but you're not part of the yeshiva. Then the Bacher said, what about meals? And what about even getting monthly stipend? Reb David said, yeah, you can have a monthly stipend, but you're still not part of the yeshiva. So the Bacher asked Reb David, so what does it mean not to be part of the yeshiva? I get all the perks of being in yeshiva. Reb David said, I want you to know that I daven for every one of my Talmidim. And when I told you I can't take you into the yeshiva, it's because I have no more space to daven for any more people. So Mamela, I can't take you into yeshiva because taking you into yeshiva means I'm going to daven for you. Because I daven for all my Talmidim. And I don't have the physical, emotional strength to add another person in my tefillah. Which is stamazay, just a musar haskel to the type of Rebbe Reb David Soloveitchik was and the type of davening that he had. That means he focused on every specific yochid and he had no more room. You know, Baruch Hashem, today we have Rabbeim of, you know, in my son's yeshiva in Queens, each Rebbe, this is already the second year, I saw this already, maybe third year already, that the Rebbe asks for the Talmud's name before he starts the year, and he davens for each Talmud, that the Talmud should be matzliach. It's very special that we daven for our Talmidim. If we look at our Talmidim like they're our children, we want them to succeed. So Moshe Rabbeinu had a special connection to Yeshua, he was his Talmud, and he had to go extra for his Talmud. The Kli Yoker gives another answer. The Kli Yoker says because Yeshua came from Shevet Yosef. Yosef, we know, struggled with Lashon Hara. Yosef, we know, was guilty, perhaps, in way back in Sefer Bereishis, of speaking ill of his brothers. Even though we spoke about that then, what does that mean? So Yeshua was, Moshe Rabbeinu was nervous, since Yeshua comes from a family of Baal Medabre Lashon Hara, he wanted to give him the extra protection. Another pshat that's found is because Yeshua represented Mesiras HaTorah. Yeshua, what do we say in the Mishnah of us? Moshe Kibbutz Torah Mesirah Mesorah Yeshua. Yeshua was the next in line in the Mesirah HaTorah. If Yeshua were to veer off the path, what would be with Torah? If Yeshua would get caught up in the Maisa Miraglim and Chas V'Shalom give the wrong report, where would that leave the Olam HaTorah? Where would that leave Torah? Torah needs to be given over in such a pure
way, if Yeshua would have not been successful, not just would the report about Eretz Yisrael be negative, but would affect the Mesiris HaTayr. And then perhaps my famous pshat that I'd like to say over from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. This is a great pshat to say over. Say this over to your wife, say this over to your daughter, say this over to all the women in your life. You're guaranteed to get an extra portion for dessert. Or if you get called on to speak at a family simcha, this Rabbi Yaakov is a great, great Rabbi Yaakov to remember. Rabbi Yaakov says, why was it that Yeshua got the tefillah from Moshe and not Kalev? Says Rabbi Yaakov, because who was Kalev married to? Kalev was married to Miriam. Zogt Rabbi Yaakov, when you have an isha chashuva, when you have a good wife, she will protect you. She will make sure you stay on the straight and narrow. Kalev didn't need it. No, the only kasha is, so why did Kalev felt he still needed it? Because he went to Kivit Tzadikim. Okay, could be, there's another shot on why he went to Kivit Tzadikim, but we'll, maybe for a different time. But the point is, Yeshua, Moshe Rabbeinu felt that he does not need to give Yeshua, he does not need to give Kalev the same tefillah, because he was confident that Kalev would make the right decision because of who his wife was. Now, to the best of my knowledge, Miriam did not come on the trip. This was a men's only trip. Terry says, that's what it means to have a good wife. A person has a wife who is being mechazikim, a wife who's pushing him, even when she's not there with you in person, she makes sure you stay in the straight and narrow. But Yeshua, at this time, I don't know if he was married at all, he only got married later. So Yeshua was more vulnerable to making bad decisions, and that's why Kodesh Baruch Hu, that's why Moshe had to specifically daven to make sure he stays on the straight and narrow pshat. Again, a beautiful pshat, always good if you have to speak about a woman, or especially your wife, or your mother, or someone in your life. It's a very, very important vart to remember from Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky on this week's parasha. Okay. There's a discussion over here in the Rishonim. Pasuk says that Hashem called Yeshua Benun, Hoshea Benun Yehoshua, which sounds like that until this story, his name was always Hoshea. But we have Psukim earlier in the Chumash where his name is Yehoshua, so what exactly was his name? So Rabbeinu Bechaya learns that his name was really Hoshea. That was really his name. And his name was Hoshea, and Moshe Rabbeinu changed it only now. So what about all those psukim earlier that have the name Yeshua? So he writes that since Moshe Rabbeinu knew, Hashem knew, that he was going to change his name, they wrote it al-shem asida. They wrote his name Yeshua based on what's going to happen in the future. And he says, kimoi basya bas pare. What does that mean? So he's bavorning a kasha, which I mentioned many times before. The first time I heard this kasha was actually from Rabbi Spiegel, once on a Achron Shel Pesach. I heard this from him many, many years ago. He has the famous kasha, to why is Moshe Rabbeinu's name Moshe? The Medrash has his kash. Moshe Rabbeinu has many names. All of his names, or many of his names, are reflective of the great stature of Moshe Rabbeinu. Yet the name that he sticks with is the name Moshe. Where did he get that name from? That was Basya Bas Pari's name. Kimin Amayim Mishisiu, because he was pulled out of the water. That's the name that sticks with Moshe Rabbeinu for eternity? The name that doesn't reflect any of his greatness? That was the kash. So Rabbeinu Bechaya says, yeah, that's the Akaris HaToiv. He writes over here, that's why she got the name, because of all that she did. So the same thing with he writes over here, I want to read you his Lashon, it's a fantastic Lashon. He writes over here, Ki l'chavoid Moshe shahaya asa l'kar Yeshua, l'iratisa l'askir b'shem achar, out of respect. And then he says, v'chematzinu b'basya b'as parish shekar yishmai Moshe, v'lichvoidoi shahasa b'as melch v'nizgayra l'ikara kosh baruch b'shem achar elaba. Hashem only named him that. That's the name he goes by. Out of respect for the person who called him. Same thing with Moshe. Since Moshe Rabbeinu named him Yeshua, he gets the name Yeshua even earlier on in the Chumash. Okay, there's a much to talk about in the Yud and the Hey. Ka Yoshiacha is Yud Hey. That Hashem, Moshe Rabbeinu Davin, that Hashem should save you from Asas Meragim. So the Arachayim HaKadosh already asks the obvious kasha, what do you need the Yud and the Hey for? Davin, so you'll daven for him. What's the role of the Yud in the Hay? So he writes that the Yud is supposed to be, corresponds, the Yud of that he added to his name, right? His name was Hoshea, and now his name is Yoshua. He has an extra Yud. So the Yud is supposed to be 10. So 10 is supposed to be able to combat the 10 Miraglim. So Reb Steinman asks, that doesn't really answer too much, whatever that means. So what does that mean? But whatever the pshat is, the Arachayim HaKadosh says that the Yud from Hoshea is now able to combat the 10 Meraglim. Rabbi Soloveitchik explained that the Yud in the Hay is relevant to something else. The Medrash tells us that where did the Yud from Hoshea's none appear from. So the Medrash tells us that Sarai's name was Sarai with the Yud. Hashem changed her name to Sarah. So the Yud was all Fatayna. The Yud said, what's going to be with me? I was attached to the name of this great woman. You just cut me down. So Medrash says, don't worry, you'll go on to Yeshua's name. So Rabbi Soloveitchik explained, what was the difference between Sarai and Sarah? So Rabbi Soloveitchik explained, the Yud versus the Hey is that the Yud is much more individual, Proteus. Sarai means that she was the Sarah for her family. Sarai, when you drop the Yud, and now you drop the Yud, and now you're Sarah, you're Aim L'Chochai. Now you open yourself up to all of mankind. So Rabbi Soloveitchik said the same thing with Yeshua. Yeshua needed to become more, instead of being so Hoshea with the Hey, which means he was more open general, he needs to become a little bit more Proteus. He needs to be a little bit more to himself and not be affected by the general mass, be more to himself. Okay, so there's a famous kasha over here that why is his name Bin Nun? Why is his name not Ben Nun? Why is he Bin Nun? He should be Ben Nun. So one answer that I saw is actually interesting because Hoshea's father's name was Nun, let's say. But Moshe Rabbeinu was his prized Rebbe. We know that a Rebbe can, as we mentioned earlier, a Rebbe can be like a father figure. So because Moshe Rabbeinu was such an important role, it diminished a little bit from the father. So instead of being Ben Nun, it's Bin Nun. The Stipler has a Shtickel Torah over here, which is interesting. He says, why is it Bin Nun? So he says like this, he says, because when you took the Yud and you put it to Hoshea, so you actually have to add two little dots under the Yud. You have to have the Nekudas. You have to put the two little dots under the Yud. The Shva. So says the Stipler, where did you get those dots from? So he says they took it from the word Ben. The word Ben is a segel. So two of those dots they took to go under the Yud, and therefore you have the Yoshua, and you're just left with one dot under the Ben, and that's why it's Bin Nun. That was the Stipler's trap. So I saw this trap in the Stipler, and then I remember that I heard that Rav Shechter quoted such a pshat. He didn't say b'shem the Stipler, and he didn't like it so much because he thought that, you know, these dots don't really appear in the Torah. So it's a little bit of a shtickle Torah. But l'maisa, the Stipler says such a pshat, that the reason why it's Bin Nun is because they had to take away the two dots to get it under the Yud, and you only left with, you took the segel, and you took away two dots to make a shva under the Yud, and you're just left with a dot under the Ben, and therefore it becomes Bin. Okay. It's a little bit of a shtickle Torah. The Torah lays out for us the names of all the Meraglim. The Gemara tells us that the Meraglim's names were all reflective of their sin, their role in the Chet HaEgel, in the Chet HaMeraglim, which means that when they were named, what they were named by their parents, it was Al Shem Ha'asid, which means when their parents named them at infancy, they already knew or someone knew that they were going to eventually sin in the Chet HaMeraglim. The Pnei Yeshua has a kasha that we know, we have based on a Tosfos, that we don't name children after Rishayim. So the Pnei Yeshua has a kasha that one of the names of the Tanoim was Elazar ben Shamua. Tanor Amayro was Elazar ben Shamua. That was one of the names of the Meraglim, Shamua ben Zakur. So how could they have such a name that would be mean that someone named after a Rasha? So yeah, such a kasha, how to explain it. But in any case, Rav Moshe Feinstein, not in Darish Moshe, but Rav Moshe Feinstein has a sefer that they came out with different speeches he gave and different comments that he made. This came out by Rabbi Fischelis. I think Rabbi Fischelis is a son-in-law by Rav Moshe, a grandson-in-law by Rav Moshe. So he came out with the sefer, and he says that Rav Moshe explained that the whole idea of the Meraglim is what we call today Afrum Echeshbin. Right, they were doing a Afrum Echeshbin. They thought that the best thing for Klal Yisrael is to not go into Eretz Yisrael. So they threw the whole story with Afrum Echeshbin. So with Afrum Echeshbin. So I mentioned once in the past from my Rosh Hashiva Bzalag Epstein, who set off an Alta from Kelm, that we can do more damage with Afrum Lishma fight or Afrum Lishma Macha than all the Roman generals can do with what they did in the Beis Hamikdash. Everything's up. It's Afrum Cheshbon. It's Lishma. It's Afrum. So Moshe Feinstein points out that's why over here, perhaps the list of the Nesiim is Al Pi Chashivas, is the more Chashiv you are, the more times you come up with Afrum Cheshbon. And the frumer you are, you come up with more frumer cheshbonis. Those people that Yeshua and Kalev weren't on the top of the list, so they weren't so oiski cheshbon, but frumer cheshbonis. They followed whatever it says. Moshe Rabbeinu said, "Come back with a report." They came back with a report. The problem is today everyone is so smart; they know all the chumros, and they know all the kulos, and all the loopholes. So they frumer cheshbon themselves out of halacha. So sometimes if you don't know so much, so you just follow, you what we call today a simple Jew. You do what you're told. The problem is today everyone knows everything. They know a kula here, they know a shtickle terry here. Boom. They work out the whole system to the way they want it to be. But those Jews that are just simple Jews, they do what they're supposed to do. They have a much more simpler approach to life. Okay. We are running very short on time, and we did not get to a lot of what I wanted to get to. So let's try to pick up some speed and cover some more material. There's a pasuk later on, the Torah tells us that after they come back with their report, and we all know by now what the report was, but the pasuk tells us that Kolev quiets the crowd towards Moshe, meaning to convince them to Moshe Rabbeinu. But Yom, and he says, "All in Allah, let's go up. The irashnu oisay kiyoch anuchala, we can handle it." So, what exactly was Amram's role over here? So, Reb Ruderman, the great Nei Yisrael Rosh Hashiva, we could really talk a lot about his life, a fascinating life Reb Ruderman had. And how he ended up in Eretz Yisrael, and he wanted to go back to Europe, but instead he stayed in Eretz Yisrael under the direction of certain people. But in any case, Reb Ruderman pointed out over here a very important lesson in life. He says, why did Kalev step up to the podium and start giving drushes? What's going on over here? Yeshua didn't give any drushes. So he says that Kalev had a koyach, he had a power. He was able to be influential speaker. And the Torah is teaching us that when a person has a koyach, he has to act on it. Kalev had an ability to speak to the mass. Very often you have in life, you have people that have talents and they don't want to use it. They don't like davening for the Amid. They don't like giving shurim. No, what are you talking about? You have a talent, you have to use it. You got to use what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave you. That's what we always say is fake anivus. So he said that Kalev had a kayach to speak to the mass. And therefore, since Kali was able to speak to the mass, he stepped up to the podium and he decided to give a speech to try to motivate and get the people to improve. The question is, why did they listen to Kali? So we mentioned earlier, because Kali gave off the impression that he's on their side. He wasn't giving off the impression like Yeshua that was honest. He was giving off the impression that he's on their side, so they wanted to hear what he had to say. Therefore, they gave him the podium, they gave him the chance to speak. There's a Gavaldi Gavard over here from Rav Koppelman, another great Rosh Hashiva. Rav Koppelman points out over here, where did the Meraglim go so wrong? Where did the Meraglim go so wrong? So he says, a Gavaldi Yisoid, Rav Koppelman explains that the Meraglim were a reflection of the messenger. They were a reflection of those who sent them. They were a shliach. We have a klal, shluchi shalodim kemoise. Says Rav Koppelman, the Meraglim started off fantastic. The moment they stepped into the role as Shluchim of Bnei Yisrael, they got affected by the Bnei Yisrael's negative attitude. Because we are a Shliach of the Meshaleach, the messenger, is reflected by the one who sent him. Therefore, says Reb Koppelman, that's where the Meraglim went wrong. Not intrinsically the Meraglim were bad people. But the moment they stepped into the shoes that representing Klal Yisrael, they took on all the negativity that Klal Yisrael had. And the Melech Zokt Reb Koppelman, a Gevaldig Yisoid, he says that we today are all messengers of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We were sent on this world to be a messenger of Hashem. And when we remember that, and we tap into that, then we can be like HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We're in His shoes, we're in His place. We're getting His Kedusha. But the moment we veer off from our shlichos and we decide to do our own thing, then we lose that connection. It's a very important message in life to figure out who you are a messenger of and realize your role. Then the pasuk tells us that after the report comes down, Vatisa kolo edo vayitnu es koilam vayivku. Vayivku ha'om balaylahu, the famous cry of the famous night balaylahu, we all know it's the night of Tisha B'Av. But if Koppelman also points out that crying was the mistake. Crying equals yish. Yish is not something for Jewish people. We all know the famous line, yish loikona. You don't get anything in life with your miyayish. Says a couple of men, they cry. What are you crying for? Crying means all lost is all hope is lost. Why is all hope lost? So Zakhtu Kopaman, the mistake over here was the crying. And this crying is something we still feel out of Yom HaZeh. This day became marked as a day in Jewish history. Tisha B'Av is a day designated for mourning, suffering, and pain. we commemorate, or we hope this year there won't be a Tisha B'Av, or there'll be a Tisha B'Av like the Mishnah describes, a Yom Simcha, a great joyous day. But we know that throughout history, this day has always been tainted with negativity and heartbreak for the Jewish people. We know both Bate Mikdashim were destroyed on Tisha B'Av. We know that the Spanish expulsion of 1492, which according to the Rishonim of that time, was the biggest tragedy from the times of the Churban, that happened also on Tisha B'Av. And what a lot of people don't focus on is the start of World War I was also on Tisha B'Av. And many people say, well, what does World War I have to do with the Holocaust? The answer is, if you follow history, that there, in my humble opinion, obviously putting aside HaKadosh Baruch Hu's involvement in the world, but Al Pi Derech HaTeva, if not for a World War I, there probably would have not been a World War II or a Holocaust for that matter. Much of what happened to Germany and the German people was a direct reflection of World War I, the Treaty of Versailles, the way they lost the war, the embarrassment, the debt that the German people had coming out of World War I. It definitely set the stage for a Holocaust. It set the stage for a Hitler to rise to power. So if not for World War I, it's very likely, at least from a historical standpoint, there probably wouldn't have been a Holocaust, there wouldn't have been a Hitler. None of that would have rose to power. But again, obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has his plans. But Lamaisa, World War I did start on Tisha B'Av. But there's another date that is reflected in Chazal, it's in the Rishonim. The Torah brings down, it's found in Shulchan Aruch as well, that there's a tainus of the 17th day of Elul. What is the tainus of the 17th day of Elul? That was the day that the Meraglim died. So the Beis Yosef and the Bach, they all try to mutcha with. So why is that a day of fasting? Why do we fast the day that the Meraglim died? So some people say because they died without ever obtaining tshuva. The Meraglim never were able to get tshuva. It's a pretty amazing thing. The Chet Egel, we were able to get tshuva. But the Cheta Meraglim, we were never able to get. Those that were involved in the crime never were able to obtain tshuva. And it's interesting, I did not know this till this year, that the day that the Germans invaded Poland, which really was the beginning of the end of European Jewry, was September 1st, 1939, which was Yud Zayin Elul as well. So these are days that are misugal in Jewish history for bad things. These are not joyous days. We just finished another very difficult day in Jewish history, Chav Sivan. This past Monday was a day of also a lot of heartbreak in Jewish history. Terrible destruction of 1648, 1649, thousands of Jews being murdered, which also led into other areas of history. But again, there are certain days in the Jewish calendar that are just not misugal for Jewish history. Okay, now, how does Moshe Rabbeinu get some form of defense for the Jewish people? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is very mad right now. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the pasuk tells us, Hashem basically says, oh, what am I going to do with these people? What am I going to do with them? But what more am I going to do with these people? How much more are they going to push my buttons? They're not going to trust me. Hashem tells Moshe, you know what? Let's scratch these guys. We'll knock them all out. And we'll start again with you. Which most people that were self-centered would be like, okay, sure, no problem. I'm still the leader. I don't care who my people are. Because Moshe Rabbeinu was a real leader, not like the politicians that we see today that are so corrupt and so self-absorbed and so selfish. Moshe Rabbeinu was never about him. It was always about the people. Moshe Rabbeinu right away comes to the defense. What is Moshe Rabbeinu's defense? Moshe Rabbeinu was a defense lawyer. What was his claim? And if you look at the psukim, his defense is very similar to what he plays by the Chet HaEgel. He says, what are the people going to say? What are the people going to say? They're going to say that what? Hashem, you're so powerful, you're so mighty, and what do? You take them out of Egypt, you put them in the desert, and you kill them all in the desert. But where's the godless HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Kosh Baruch Hu doesn't have the power. He's not strong. He's not powerful. And that's really what gets HaKadosh Baruch Hu to calm down, Kaviyachol, is this claim of Chil Hashem. Which is fascinating. And the Sforner writes something which scares me when I read it. The Sforner says, why Taka couldn't the Meraglim get Slicha V'Kapara? Says the Sforner, because of Chil Hashem. Chil Hashem is so severe. It's so terrible. And when you're mechal Hashem, it's very hard to get tshuva for that. Zok Moshe Rabbeinu to Hashem, you're going to make a chil Hashem. If you kill the Jewish people, if you kill the whole story, you're going to cause the world to think low of you. Hashem said, that's tak lecheshem. So the Sukkas David Kriyat explains that when a person is mechal Hashem, the only way back is not tshuva meyir, it has to be tshuva meyahavu. You have to express love to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You have to make a kiddush Hashem. You have to express Hashem's greatness. And that's the only way to get tikkun for chil Hashem. But I saw a kasha from Rebbe Eliyahu Baruch Finkel. He asks a kasha, I think he quotes him Shem Abul Yashiv. Why did we never play this Chus Avos card? We all know from the Rosh Hashanah davening, we spend over and over, save us because of our father Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov. Nowhere did Moshe Rabbeinu pull that card. Why did Moshe Rabbeinu say, Hashem, how can you annihilate your people? What happened to the promise of Avraham, Yitzchak and Yaakov? What happened to them? So he quotes over here, he says in Gavaldik, he's so, his mom's beautiful. He says that by the Meraglim we play that card. I'm sorry, by the Chet Egel. Because Lamaisa, at the end of the day, by the Chet Egel, they were doing it L'Shem Shemayim. They wanted to get close to Hashem, and they felt the only way to get close to Hashem is with an emtsoi, a middleman. And they made their own cheshbon. He said the others did that also. The others made cheshbonis. That's why Yaakov married two sisters, and that's why Avraham Avinu married Hagar. They made their own cheshbonis because they did it lishma. But he says over here, but the Meraglim, they spoke ill of Eretz Yisrael. Our others would never do that. Speaking ill of Eretz Yisrael, our others loved Eretz Yisrael. They had a huge chunk of Eretz Yisrael. Zogt Rebbe Baruch Finkel, when it comes to speaking ill, you can't use the others. That was the antithesis of the others. The others never stood for such behavior. When you try to go against the others, you can't come turn around and ask the others to come and defend you, which might answer the kasha that we had earlier. What was the difference between the Meraglim and the Chet Egel? The answer is the Meraglim. Maybe they did have a Frum Cheshbon. But when you're going to bash something, you're going to speak ill of something, you can't use Frum Cheshbonis. When it came to the Chet Egel, they also made Cheshbonis. We need an Emtsoi, we need a middle person, but at least they were striving to get closer to the Kaddish Baruch Hu. Over here, they were striving to get further from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That doesn't work. I want to get to... it's really, really late. I want to get to at least one more thought for this evening. Pasuk Mem, there's a story over here which goes mamish on under the radar. After HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes down hard on the Meraglim, the Pasuk tells us something that... Vayashkimu HaBoiker. They wake up in the morning, Vayalu El Roisha Harlem, and they go to the top of the mountain saying, Hineinu, here we are, Valinu El HaMokim, Hashem HaShem, Kichatonu. We want to go now to Eretz Yisrael. We regret our decision. We messed up. Take two. We want to go to the land. What are you doing? Hashem said you're not going in. And now you want to go? You're not going to be successful. Al talu, don't go up. You're going up alone. You don't have Hashem with you. He's not going to fight your enemies. You're going into like we spoke about earlier, you're going into danger with no protection. And they go up there, and of course they get annihilated. So the question that many Mefarshim ask over here is, this sounds like they had genuine charata. So if they had genuine charata, why couldn't they obtain slicha v'kapara? So they say a word from the Baal Shem Tov, which is so beautiful. Baal Shem Tov says, you have to read the pasuk like this. They woke up in the morning, they went to the top of the mountain. And they said, Hinenu v'olinu el ha-mokoyim, asher omer Hashem ki chatanu. Hashem said we sinned. We don't think we sinned. We don't think we're wrong. But Hashem said we sinned. So if Hashem said we sinned, we want forgiveness. That's nishken mechila. How many times have people gotten into disagreements with their spouse and they say, well, you said I was wrong, so I'm apologizing. It's not an apology. Apology means you realize you were wrong. Says the Baal Shem Tov, they didn't want to realize they were wrong. They were saying, Asher Omar Hashem ki chatanu. Hashem said we sinned. We don't think we sinned. We think we were totally in the right. But we saw what happened, so we'll go with your version. That was not a genuine, that was not a lishma type of slicha. And because it was not a lishma type of slicha, that's why they were not able to obtain slicha v'kapar. The person has to come to HaKadosh Baruch Hu with an honesty, with a sincerity, that I realize my mistakes and I realize my flaws. Again, I did not have enough time to get to everything. I'll just leave you off with a beautiful idea I heard b'shem Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik explained, we know by the mitzvah of tzitzis, we have a mitzvah of lavan and a mitzvah of tcheles, white strings and blue strings. That's the whole tumult today if we have tcheles with Zman Hazeh. Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed out that the lavan represents clarity, when things make sense in life. The tcheles represents lack of clarity, lack of understanding the world. And sometimes we have to have those two things work together. I think it's such a powerful idea. We live in a world today that sometimes we understand things and sometimes it's just chelas. Tragedy upon tragedy and all the things that have happened to us, it's just chelas. It's not clear to us, but we have to work with both of them. And he said it even further. Rabbi Salvejik said that's why a person needs to have a Rebbe. That was a mistake of Kairach. A person has to have a Rebbe to get him through the difficult patches, the difficult times with the chelas, when he doesn't understand. And Kairach said, no, we don't need leadership. We can all be our own Rebbe. And that was Kairach's mistake, his flaw. Because we need guidance, we need leadership, we need people to show us what to do, how to navigate in the blue of life, in the darkness, the lack of clarity. When we don't understand the will and want of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we need guidance, we need Hadracha. And that's the idea of the Tchelas and the love and the two mitzvahs that we have in the mitzvah of Tzitzis. Okay, Rabbi Yisai.